That's right, yeah. I'm going to show you all this wonderful data that matches your models within its error bars, but whatever that means. So I'm going to talk just about a few things. I don't know how many of you might be aware of catecholsing variables, so I'll tell you a little bit about those and a little bit about what toads are. And if you haven't read papers about toads, you should. They're at least kind of fun. There's some jokes slipped into them here and there, so some fun things to read about. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about white dwarf temperatures in accreting systems, and these are of real interest to a lot of people in this room in terms of what's going on with how you heat a white dwarf after it's maybe cooled a bit and then you re-accrete it. And then I'm going to move on to talk a little bit about the mass donors. And this is a subject that I've been working on for about the past 5 years or something, trying to, initially my hope was to move to the mass donors to understand the masses and the velocities in the system much better. But as you'll see, it was an interesting diversion direction, but we still haven't made any progress much in mass estimates there. And then I'm going to talk about a specific case of a magnetic system called EF Eridanus, which is perplexing to say the least. So just to tell you about white dwarf binaries or cataclysmic variables if you don't know about them, their orbital periods range from about 80 minutes to 10 hours. There's a few that are longer, and there's some interesting objects that are shorter orbital periods, but in those, the two objects are degenerate stars, neutron stars, or white dwarfs. The mass donors are thought to fill their Roche lobes, and they have Roche lobe overflow. Again, there are some cases where the mass donor fills its Roche lobe by evolution. It actually expands to meet its Roche lobe. And there's a belief, which we all, I think, agree, although we're not maybe sure of the exact details, that they have an evolution from long orbital period to short orbital period with time. And they could be broadly broken into two classes, into non-magnetic and magnetic, which is based on the magnetic field strength of the white dwarf. And in the non-magnetic systems, the white dwarf has a field strength that's below some measurable amount, and that's usually taken to be something like 1 megagauss or less. So we don't know what their field strengths are, so we just assume it's low, since we don't see any evidence of them having a high magnetic field. And in the magnetic cases, you can further subdivide them into two categories. These things called IPs or intermediate polars, and the highly magnetic systems called polars. I won't say much today about intermediate polars. They're actually an observational nightmare to try to understand. I just had a student finish a PhD thesis on one intermediate polar, and we started out with the great expectations we would understand everything about the star, and in the end we understood probably less than when we started, but they're really quite a nightmare, and so I would claim avoid those like the plague. But down here in polars actually seem to be kind of nice systems you can at least make some understanding in. The white dwarfs are well known in those systems in terms of you can actually observe the white dwarf at times. And they have magnetic fields that are 10 to 250,000 megagauss. It's the highest one known. There's some interest maybe in high field white dwarfs. In the field, you see white dwarfs with very high magnetic fields, up to maybe 600 megagauss or something. But you don't see those in cataclysmic variables at all. And so it's not clear why that is.
That's only a factor of 2 or 3 above your other number.
Well, if you look at the distribution, maybe I should say, of single white dwarfs with fields above, say, 400 megagauss, and you believe it's the same distribution in CVs, we should have found 5, and we found 0. So, but it could be that since you find most CVs by something that has to do with accretion, at those high magnetic fields, you might have no accretion. The magnetic field might completely keep accretion away, and so therefore you might just never find them. So it could just be a selection effect, as all things in observations could be. So here's a typical drawing of what we think a dwarf novae looks like, or a non-magnetic white dwarf binary. So the white dwarf sits here in the middle of an accretion disk. The accretion disk can be optically thin or optically thick. In reality, it sort of has components of both parts. The secondary star is more or less egg-shaped, and it fills its Roche lobe. Materials transferred through the inner Lagrangian point over toward the white dwarf, where in the non-magnetic case, it forms an accretion disk. The systems I'm going to be talking about today, to give you an idea of scale, this is the size of the sun. So they're fairly small. They have very short orbital periods, less than 2 hours in most cases for the ones I'm going to talk about today. So they're very, very small, compact systems. They're also very low in luminosity, so most of these objects in the optical world where most of us live are faint sources to study. They get a little brighter at higher energies, and they get a little brighter in the infrared. So we've progressed out over time to actually observe them in different wave bands. The other type of systems we'll be talking a little bit about today, the magnetic systems or the pulsars, are thought to look something like this, where, again, the secondary star or the mass donor star is some low-mass main sequence star or something like that, and it fills its Roche lobe. There's mass transfer that starts out in a ballistic stream, so it's in the orbital plane. It's governed just by Newton's law. It follows gravity, so it stays in the orbital field. But at some point, the white dwarf has a high enough magnetic field that this material gets elevated out of the orbital plane, follows the magnetic field lines down onto the surface of the white dwarf, and crashes onto the surface in a fairly localized region. So the assumption is, and observation tends to agree, that the material at some point must become fully ionized. Otherwise, it wouldn't follow the magnetic field lines. And there has never been a case where we've seen the gas stream sort of continue on so that maybe some of the material is ionized and some of it isn't. It all seems to follow along the star. Now, this is an idealized view, and in reality, material probably comes right from here directly to the white dwarf on other field lines, and there's a big mess where these two magnetic fields interact with each other. And if somebody's looking for a great thesis topic, that would be a good one to do. That's never been fully modeled or even really attempted.
Why is there no disk?
The material is grabbed prior to the radius at which the tidal interaction would cause the material to form a disk around the white dwarf. So if this material kept coming, it would start to orbit the white dwarf, eventually come back upon itself and run into itself and form a disk. But long before it gets to that radius, it gets pulled out of the orbital plane by the magnetic field. So just no disk is ever seen. Well, that's what we were just talking about. And someone should do that. Sure, it probably does, but it's never been modeled. We never see any effects of that we know of. But these systems, when you draw them like this, they look really nice. When you observe them, they aren't quite so nice. There's probably material moving all over the place in these systems, but it's never been modeled. The gas stream has been modeled in pretty good detail. The accretion column has been modeled in good detail. But no one's ever done a full model of both stars and their interaction of their magnetic fields with each other.
Is there any way to map out the magnetic field itself?
Polarization studies are the best way to do that, or looking at velocities, use emission lines to try to map the velocities. If you look at a system that's eclipsing, so you know its inclination and you kind of know the geometry, you can actually follow the material, not individual pieces, but you can follow this gas stream and this particular magnetic stream in the emission lines themselves. You can see components that have those velocities, and you can reconstruct a three-dimensional map.
When you do that, it's a mess?
It's a mess because at the 80% level, the emission line components follow this sort of a pattern. But at the 20% level, there's emission components that you don't know where they're from. You can't connect them up with each other. They seem to be random, but they might not be. They might be field lines that come directly from here to here with material in it, things like that. So. That's right. It's locked or very close to being locked. It sometimes has a little wiggle where it has some maybe periodic motion back and forth. And these systems, I'll mention in a little bit, they have high and low states where the mass transfer is on and where the mass transfer is off or at some low level. And during the times that it's off, the white dwarf might become asynchronous. But as soon as it turns back on, it locks it back in place. And it's a good question. No one knows. It's probably related to some kind of star spot activity on the secondary star. That's the best guess. But how it's related is pretty unknown. And it probably happens in dwarf novae as well. It should. If they have the same kinds of secondary stars and it's related to stellar activity cycles, there should be stoppages of mass transfer in those systems as well. But you can't tell because the accretion disk dominates all the light in the optical. So if you observe them only in the optical, you might not know if it was only turned off for a week or 2 weeks or something. Okay, so the focus now is on these short period systems called TODES. And TODES was an acronym that I invented on an airplane flight to Italy many years ago, mostly because I was bored on the airplane and just sort of came up with this acronym and started writing down every word I could think of that had to do with these and saw what they spelled. But it's kind of neat. It's carried on. It's made some people mad and some people happy. But you know, it's like artwork. If your artwork makes people think about it, whether it's good or bad, it's better than if they just don't think about it at all. So the toads have these properties, which over the years have actually evolved a little bit into, they started out by being objects that just had these enormous outbursts. They had amplitudes of 6 up to almost 10 magnitudes of an outburst in the optical. But they're not a novae. They're not the classical novae. They're just a dwarf novae outburst. But since then, there's been other properties that have come along that seem to be unique to this group. So maybe it wasn't such a farce to start it out. They almost entirely only have super outbursts. And if you're not familiar with this sort of lingo of dwarf novae, things like SS Cygni or U Geminorum, the kind of popular canonical dwarf novae, have outbursts that are fairly periodic. And those outbursts occur maybe on a monthly time scale. They have amplitudes of 2 to 5 magnitudes, and they last for a week or so. Where these objects have what are called super outbursts, and they're super because they're brighter, and they, in some cases here, they only occur on decade time scales or longer, and they might last for a month before the object cools back down. And it's believed that the difference is that these have very low mass transfer rates. They just fill their accretion disk up kind of slowly, and it takes a long time before that material, the viscosity of the disk causes that material to crash onto the surface of the white dwarf.
Is it really bimodal?
It's almost bimodal. There are a few systems that show super outbursts and outbursts. These are the SU UMA stars. They're all short period systems. But generally, the ones with the largest super outbursts are never show regular outbursts. There's a few that have had observations of a single bright point, and whether it's an outburst or super outburst, you don't know. So there is probably some crossover ground, but it's small. All of these systems have very short orbital periods, so they're probably the very oldest of cataclysmic variables, very like maybe 2 giga-years or 4 giga-years or older. It appears that in all of them, the mass donors are some sort of degenerate type object. They're very low mass, less than 0.08 or 0.06 solar masses, so they're not really a star anymore. They're some degenerate object. There's also the possibility that these systems formed with brown dwarf secondaries, that they never had a secondary that was a main sequence star. And that awaits some theoretical work and also some observations of the secondary to confirm that. And the secondary temperatures are pretty low. They're less than 2,000 degrees Kelvin, which makes for really nasty atmospheres. If you've looked into any atmospheric work on things that are cool, the molecules start to form, and as soon as you get molecules forming, then it's very, very difficult to understand the atmospheres, because a temperature change of a few hundred degrees can cause the atmosphere to look completely differently. And they also don't work very well as black bodies anymore. Cool objects, atmospheres aren't black bodies. And just some famous examples here of these kinds of stars. So we're going to concentrate a little bit on those objects and look at where they might be in their evolution and how they got there. This is a schematic drawing of a typical evolution of a single cataclysmic variable that started, in this case, at some long orbital period, maybe 6 hours or something. And what I mean by started at 6 hours, at 6 hours, the secondary star and its Roche lobe came in contact with each other. So mass transfer started. And if we were out observing and saw this system, we would all of a sudden say, oh, now it's a cataclysmic variable. Before that, it would be a white dwarf, red dwarf pair. It's these two stars orbiting each other. So it started mass transfer. And the black numbers here, starting at 0.3 and going down to 7, are the ages in giga years that this thing evolved. So it evolves along this green curve. And you can see it covers this orbital period range fairly quickly. And it spends most of its time down here in this very short orbital period range of very low mass transfer rates and in short orbital periods. There's this sort of missing area here called the period gap, which is thought to have something to do with the secondary star becoming fully convective. So as on the main sequence, stars at about 3/10 of a solar mass are thought to become fully convective. In interacting binaries, the mass is more like 0.2. But at some point, they become fully convective. It's thought that they shrink in size. And so if they shrink in size, they lose contact with the Roche lobe. Therefore, mass transfer stops, and the system is no longer a cataclysmic binary. It's now a red dwarf, white dwarf pair that's crossing through this period space, but you don't observe it as a cataclysmic binary. And then mass transfer starts again as the orbit gets small enough that the Roche lobe touches the surface of the secondary, and it follows this track to very low M dots. The curve in this track is where the secondary star becomes degenerate, where it stops becoming a star and starts becoming some degenerate object. So that occurs when the secondary is somewhere near 0.06 solar masses. So this is a canonical view. Most people agree with it. The details can be different here and there, where the period gap is and exactly the numbers, but more or less it's the view that we believe is true. Now, instead of doing this for one star, you can do this for a lot. And this is a simulation, an evolution model of 1 million cataclysmic variables, which approximates what the distribution in period and M dot would be today in our galaxy. That's what this is supposed to model. And it's a logarithmic scale over here, where the green and white areas contain basically all the cataclysmic variables. And you can see they're all down here. This is where they would all be in today's population. If you plotted an observational sequence, you would find that they're all pretty much up here. And of course, these are much brighter, so there's a higher selection effect for those. They're brighter, they have classical novae outbursts more often, they have dwarf novae outbursts more often. So observers are drawn here and theorists are drawn here. And so this seemed to be the area to attack in observations because very little was known about that area. So that's the area we sort of have been going after, myself and some collaborators and the poor students who wander too close to me and get caught up in all this kind of stuff. So one of the first things we thought we'd look at is the white dwarf temperatures, and see if there was some issue about the white dwarf temperatures between the long period systems and the short period systems that would give us some hint about the age or some hint about mass accretion. And we came at this from an observational point of view. We used HST to obtain spectroscopy in the ultraviolet of the white dwarfs, assuming the accretion disk would be a little contaminating, but not very much. And so far we've measured 38 accreting systems at various orbital periods. And just some conclusions, and then I'll show you the plot, which is maybe more dramatic than the conclusions. For a given age, the temperatures in cataclysmic variables for the white dwarfs are hotter than if they were single field white dwarfs. And of course, this is pretty easy to understand because field white dwarfs aren't accreting or accreting at very, very low levels, where the white dwarfs in cataclysmic variables are having mass thrown on them constantly. So they're accreting.
So how are you making the age determination? Just these theoretical tracks of orbital evolution?
You can do two things. You can use the theoretical tracks, but you can also look at the secondary stars. And for the long period systems anyway, the secondary stars aren't, their evolution isn't too messed up yet by the fact that they're in a close binary. So you can use them as a fiducial, set the age, and then it's a theoretical calculation and you just believe theory of their age through the rest of the tracks to get their ages.
Okay. And so the white, you just assume that the white dwarf was born at the same time as the
yeah, morning. Yeah. If they're well, I guess it has to be that way, right? If yeah. So, the temperatures here tend to get cooler as you get to lower orbital periods. Again, that seems reasonable. You have a lower mass transfer rate. You dump more material on the white dwarf. It's hotter. You dump less. It cools off. So that seems pretty likely. The temperatures we see for dwarf novae or non-magnetic white dwarfs. So these include nova-likes, dwarf novae, anything that doesn't have a high magnetic field, seem to get no cooler than about 13,000 degrees, where in the magnetic systems, the highly magnetic systems, they seem to drop to about 10,000 degrees. And in fact, they seem to be almost around 10 or 12,000 degrees regardless of their orbital period. They don't even seem to care about the orbital period too much. And the reason for that is of high debate, why that is. They are heated differently, however, because the material's thrown on their surfaces differently. And this, I thought, was such an interesting idea. And in fact, walking to lunch today, Lars kind of told me this idea from a theoretical point of view. But this is something that I don't think anyone's really thought about or done much in terms of trying to study. But when a white dwarf and red dwarf are not yet interacting, the white dwarf is cooling like a white dwarf on a cooling track. It's just getting colder and colder and colder. Well, at some point, it's going to be fairly cold, say 6,000 or 8,000 degrees. And then the system's going to become a cataclysmic variable. So all of a sudden, you're going to throw mass back onto that white dwarf. And so that white dwarf is going to have to heat up very quickly to sort of match the canonical temperature of white dwarfs at a given orbital period for accreting systems. So there must be a phase, it's probably a very rapid heating phase, where the white dwarf cranks its temperature back up because of this accretion. And there might be some interesting physics we can learn from studying systems that we think might have just had that happen to them. And there are a few of those. Now let me show you just briefly, I know it's observations, but bear with me, how we determine our temperatures. And you can laugh about how we determine them later if you like, but it's not too bad. These are two typical spectra of very low M dot, very short period toads. The top one's E.G. Cancri and the bottom one's H.V. Virgo. And this is, in fact, the one that should be pulsating, but it's not. Well, we don't think so anyway. And if you're not familiar with these kinds of spectra, this large broad feature here is Lyman alpha. This is the Lyman alpha absorption line in the white dwarf. It's incredibly broad, so it's pretty useless for trying to do anything like radial velocities, but it's really great for trying to fit the spectra because it's a large feature. The emission lines, this is Lyman alpha emission, but this is from the Earth's atmosphere. This is from Hubble, but Hubble's not far enough away from the Earth to be outside its atmosphere. So the big emission feature here might have some component from the star, but it's mostly contaminated by the Earth's atmosphere. And then these other emission lines are from the accretion that's going on in the star, from the accretion disk. But you can see that this kind of rises to the red, again, because this big Lyman alpha here. So we don't believe there's much accretion disk contamination here in any optically thin continuum emission. There's only optically thin emission here with the big carbon lines and the nitrogen lines. So these are what the spectra look like, and you try to model these with white dwarf models, and you just kind of ignore a contribution in the continuum from the accretion disk. You assume that it's negligible. And we don't model the lines at all. If you do a model fit, it looks like this. And now you can see that the model is very nice and the data are very crummy, but you more or less can see that the model fits here. And if you actually go through some kind of chi-square determination instead of just trying to eyeball fit it, and look at this in detail, the silicon lines here and over here some of the carbon lines actually do fit fairly well. So you can believe you're modeling the photosphere here in great detail. And the big Lyman alpha feature is a very temperature sensitive feature, so that works very well in your favor to try to model that. As the temperature of the white dwarf changes with the gravity of the white dwarf, the two are interlinked, then you can fit this very well in a log G temperature plane. And this particular feature here bothered us for a long time. This is a quasi-molecular feature of H2 that's in the atmosphere of the very coolest white dwarfs. And you get below about 13,000 Kelvin, the hydrogen molecules can actually stay together for a little bit and make a quasi-molecular bump there in the continuum. So that's a very good temperature indicator as well. So as I mentioned, when you fit that, you have log G and T that are intertwined. And so it's hard to disentangle those two. So what we do is we try to make some other measurements that will allow us to try to at least convince ourselves that the grid of log G and T that we picked is correct. And what we do is we try to collect nearly simultaneous spectroscopy in other wavelengths. In this case, we have two optical spectra that were taken about the same time as our Hubble spectra. And when we fit models, and here's three examples here of different log Gs and different temperatures, we don't believe that in the optical you can ever have your model be above the magnitude you measure, because in the optical you should be seeing the contribution from the white dwarf plus some contribution from the accretion disk. So if your model is greater than your flux in the optical, then it seems like that can't be the right white dwarf. So that's one check, and in this case, the top model here, which is the log G equals 7 model at a cooler temperature, exactly matches our flux. And so we would have to believe there's no accretion disk contribution here at all, and that seems unreasonable in this case. Where the log G equals 9 model seems lower than a standard accretion disk emission, so you kind of pick the model in the middle, which is as all of them, log G equals 8, and you pick a temperature out of this here. So that's one check. Now you can also, at the same time, you can play games where you map out a number of parameters simultaneously and try to look at the fit. And this is what I was telling you about, Dean, we do these things. So here we fit log G, and we look at the mass of the white dwarf, because of course you have to pick a radius. Log G doesn't tell you the mass or the radius, so you have to pick one of those. And you try to connect that with the temperature you measure, the distance to the star, and the V magnitude of the star. And you try to fit those all simultaneously in a large chi-squared grid. And when you get some fit that fits all of them at the same time, you believe that's the best you can do. Because the distance is going to confine the radius of the white dwarf, because the white dwarf is going to have some emission size to it. So this confines the radius, this confines the mass, so that sort of fixes log G. And now you've taken a little bit of the degeneracy out, because now you can get a temperature, and you can always check that against the V magnitude of the white dwarf, which is what I showed you in that last slide. It cannot be greater than the V magnitude you measure. And you want to try to make these measurements in the ultraviolet and the optical fairly close in time, because if your accretion state changes, the V flux can bounce up and down where your ultraviolet flux might not, and you're not sure you're measuring the same state of the star. So the fact that they're variables sort of adds another twist to it. But that's the way we've come up with measuring the temperatures to try to break the log G degeneracy. Now, if we plop down all of our temperatures, and we've all seen these temperatures plotted over and over today, which is great, the solid circles here are our HST measurements. So we have mostly these short period ones, and then a couple up here at long periods. The triangles here are magnetic systems, and these are all polars in this case. There's no intermediate polars at all. And you can see that mostly they lie down here for short periods, and even at long periods, they're far below the other temperatures. And then the open symbols here, there's a few open symbols here and here, are temperatures we've measured either from old IUE spectra, which aren't quite as reliable as HST spectra. The resolution was poor, so the model fitting's harder. Or the recent results that we did with FUSE. FUSE actually works out quite well to measure temperatures as well. So again, it just shows the things that we've already talked about. There seems to be hotter temperatures at longer orbital period. And these are just our measurements, so there's a number of other measurements you can fill in up here. And as you get to shorter periods, they tend to congregate around some value here and some value here, where the longer period magnetics look to be hotter than the shorter period magnetics, although there's always a few examples that defy anything. But it looks like there's clear evidence that the magnetics are cooler than the non-magnetic systems, which is the difference of a disk accretion process and a very small focused accretion process. And as we also talked about before most of you came in, it could be a difference between the actual M dot that hits the white dwarf. Right? We're basing these on, we believe that as you go to shorter orbital periods, that there's less M dot, but the assumption is that all the M dot that comes from the secondary, all the mass the secondary loses, actually falls onto the surface of the white dwarf. And in the magnetic systems, that may not be the case. So I want to move away from the white dwarfs now and just move a little bit to the mass donors, mostly because we don't know anything more about the white dwarfs. They all seem to have 0.6 solar masses, and they seem to be cool. So we're going to move to the mass donors. And the mass donors have always thought to be sort of normal K and M stars, where the longer period systems, the stars are farther apart, so the secondary star can be larger. It can fit into the orbit. So those would be the K stars. And as you move to shorter orbital period, you go through the whole sequence of M stars until you get down to M8 or M9 at the very end of the sequence, down at about 80 minutes. And the original work, which is still basically done on these systems, is that you look at the separation of the two stars as a function of their orbital period. You calculate the size of the Roche lobe, its radius, and of course the Roche lobe isn't a sphere, it's actually sort of an egg-shaped thing, but you calculate its mean radius. And then you look at some table of main sequence stars and you say, well, what main sequence star has that radius? And then you say, oh, that's the main sequence star that's in that binary. Well, for the long period systems, this seems to work pretty okay. If you observe a system with an orbital period of 5 or 6 hours and you determine its spectral type, although CV observers are not really people who determine spectral type by the proper ways, but you determine its spectral type, as we all sort of do. You match up some lines and you kind of figure out a temperature and, oh, it looks like this spectral type. It seems to work okay. When you get to the short period systems, or the systems that are between about 3 and 5 hours of orbital period, it doesn't seem to work at all. And I'll show you some examples of that. It seems like that the normal main sequence assumption is just completely goofy. And the problem is you don't know what's better. That's the real trick, right? Until we figure out what's better, you have to kind of use that. So we decided about 4 years ago to start plowing into this in the infrared, because that's where you actually can see the secondary stars. In the long period systems, you can see them in the optical a little bit, in the far red of the optical. But in the infrared, you should be able to see them all. Well, this turned out to be really great for the long period systems of about 3 hours and longer. But for the short period systems, something like 2/3 of all the ones we observed, you could still not see the secondary star, even in the infrared. The accretion disk still dominates the flux. And what it did was it basically made us want to work harder, which means going to bigger telescopes and getting longer integration times. But it also meant that you can set reliable upper limits on what the secondary star can be if you don't see it after you observe a star for 8 hours and you co-add all the data or something like that. And it turns out that in most of the short period systems, the secondary stars cannot be M stars. They just can't be M stars, or you would see them. So that was at least not a complete failure. To see them would be nice, and I'll show you we actually have observed a few of them under special conditions. So the short period ones, I basically say the high states, or even when pulsars are in high states, or in normal CVs, the accretion disk dominates the light. So you have a few times you can look at them. You can look at them in the long period CVs or when pulsars are in low states. That means their mass transfer is almost turned off, because then the stars themselves become the brightest components of the systems. When the mass transfer is on, the accretion flux is an order of 30 to 100 times greater than the flux from the stars. So there are a few special times when you can see them. And of the detailed that we have, infrared spectra, as well as some high energy spectra, the secondary stars and the material that's thrown onto the primary stars, onto the white dwarfs, seem to have CNO processing occurring. And by that I mean they seem to have highly enriched nitrogen, hardly any or no carbon, and oxygen appears to be normal. So you either notice it by looking at the spectra of the white dwarf and seeing a lot of nitrogen and hardly any carbon, or you look at the secondary star itself and in its atmosphere you see carbon depleted. It's tough to measure nitrogen in the secondary star because there are no good nitrogen lines until you get the high energy. So you don't really know about the nitrogen on the secondary, but you know about the carbon and the oxygen. And this is an interesting conundrum, how you get CNO processing to occur. And there's a few choices that people have thought about. None of them seem to work very well. But one method is that you have the secondary sweep up a bunch of material when there's a common envelope phase. So whatever the progenitor of the white dwarf was a giant or a red giant at some point, and the secondary was orbiting in its atmosphere in the common envelope. So maybe it swept up a bunch of material that was CNO processed in the white dwarf progenitor. Well, that makes the people who do common envelopes sort of, they don't like that because you have to spend a lot of time in the common envelope phase. The other idea is that you can have a classical nova outburst, so the white dwarf actually blows off some of its outer layers, and that material, some of it gets captured by the secondary star. But the secondary star is a pretty small target, and if you assume a spherical mass accretion, not much actually runs into the secondary star. So that doesn't seem to work too well. And the third choice is that the secondary somehow made it itself. And that idea, people don't like that idea too much either, because it means the secondary had to be highly evolved before it became the secondary component in the cataclysmic variable.
So let me question this.
Sure.
So what you're really saying is that the carbon is turned into nitrogen, which really means that all you actually need is not the normal CNO catalytic cycle. All you need is hot enough to make the carbon go to nitrogen.
That's right. That's right.
So that's happening at the center of the sun today.
Yeah.
So, in the sense that it's, or even actually cooler stars, less massive stars than the sun, they're not CNO, they're not living on hydrogen burning via CNO, but they are hot enough to at least do it in step one.
That's right. They are hot enough to do that, but.
So,
but it doesn't make enough.
So, if right. You see that the carbon is gone,
The carbon appears to be gone, okay. And the nitrogen appears to be 10 times enhanced. So those numbers,
but the oxygen is normal,
right? And those numbers don't seem to be able to happen the way you said. I mean, we've thought about that too, but I don't think you can make those extreme ratios. It's possible, but I don't think those ratios are that extreme. Because you then maybe have the problem of transporting it from the core too, right?
Well, but what orbital period is this seen at?
This is seen at all orbital periods.
At all orbital periods.
Yeah, at all orbital periods. Yeah, so this isn't just a short orbital period effect here. We see it at all orbital periods. So it's another thesis topic. Yeah, somebody else can work on that. So that's a tricky one. So let me show you some of the special cases so we can, this is when we can actually study the mass donors. This is a spectrum of the standard polar, AM Hercules, which, as most things that categories are named after a while, it doesn't become a member of its own category. But so it's a polar, but it's not the typical polar anymore. But it was the first one discovered and first one studied. And it's a beautiful spectrum here. It's just a beautiful emission line spectrum. And this is when mass transfer is turned on. So you look at it and you see nothing but this beautiful plasma spectra here. And you can do all kinds of measurements of temperatures and abundances and great things like that. The bottom spectrum here, which isn't reproduced really great, but the bottom spectrum is essentially the same wavelength coverage of the same star when it's in a low accretion state. So down here, there's hardly any mass transfer. And you can see H alpha is still in emission, but it's rather weak compared to it up here. And now what you see is features, absorption features, in particular out here, these big molecular features from the secondary star, titanium oxide, vanadium oxide, sodium features. So you now see the underlying secondary star in this system. Now, it's always there, of course. It's just on this plot, this particular flux level is about down here. So you just never see it. The accretion dominates everything. So polars are a real nice case to obtain spectroscopy of when they're in low states. The problem is there's no way to predict when they're in low states. They seem to be completely random. So over the past few years, I've been setting up networks of amateur astronomers that watch all these guys all the time and call me up at 3 o'clock in the morning and tell me some polar is in a low state. And then I call people who fortunately at 3 o'clock in the morning maybe are observing and have them try to get spectroscopy. Or you put in target of opportunity proposals, and when this happens, you get people. So it's worked. We've done okay. In fact, here's an example of some spectra that were taken during a low state and a high state months later. So in 1997, this bottom spectrum here is an infrared spectrum in the K band of the secondary star of a magnetic cataclysmic variable called ST Leo Minor. And the spectrum above it was taken about 6 months later when mass accretion had restarted and turned back on. And these are on the same flux scale, so you can see it gets brighter by maybe a factor of 1.5. But all the secondary star features here completely go away. You can't see them anymore, and you're just dominated by accretion. But in this low state, you can see that the emission lines completely go away. This bend over here, this sort of dip, is due to water. It's a water absorption. And this dip over here is due to water absorption as well, water in the star. So this is a late M star. And these dips here are the carbon monoxide bands, the CO bands in the star. So this is a fairly typical spectrum of about an M5 secondary star. And this is a magnetic system with about a 2-hour orbital period. So that's roughly the star you would think is the secondary star in this particular system. And down here I show the different spectrum for two reasons. One is you see the emission lines, of course, dominate the different spectrum. But the other thing you see is this rising hump over here. This is a cyclotron feature from the magnetic field. And that's what causes this slight rise over here that you can see real well in the different spectrum. So when these systems are also in high accretion states, cyclotron features become very prominent. There's a lot of material falling into the magnetic field, and you get cyclotron beaming in these. And by knowing the location of those humps, you can tell what the strength of the magnetic field is. So they're quite nice. This is an example of a fused spectrum of BY-CAM. This is the star we were talking about earlier. Here are all the hydrogen, the molecular hydrogen features in this particular system, which may or may not be associated with the star itself. But this is just an example of a very strong nitrogen feature and essentially absent carbon feature here. So this is a spectrum now of the white dwarf plus the accretion material. This is a polar there. There's no accretion disk here. So the lines are not double peaked or anything like that. These are accretion lines coming from the gas stream somewhere. And the white dwarf, the underlying white dwarf is here, and you can model the underlying white dwarf. But what you see here is this evidence even of the white dwarf spectrum of the CNO processed materials. And again, what causes it, we don't know. And this is also one that might have a circumbinary bunch of material around or something, those H2 lines. Now, even the good old famous UGEM, the star that everybody believes is well understood, we've studied it forever. Here's an infrared spectrum of UGEM. And here's two stars, single normal main sequence stars that are sort of like the secondary star in UGEM. But there's two things you'll notice that are different. One is UGEM has an emission line because it has an accretion disk. This is the bracket gamma emission line from the accretion disk. But the other thing you notice is this is a calcium feature here. And you see the calcium feature looks like it's present in all of them about the same strength. But these are the CO band heads. And you can see that they just aren't here, or they're very, very weak. And it just indicates that carbon is completely missing or very low in abundance. But this large feature here is a water feature. And it's about the same as these large water features. So oxygen must be there in about the normal amount. Now, this isn't true abundance determination, because true abundance determination requires real spectra with real signal noise and actually looking at line ratios. But that's very hard to do for most of these systems. UGEM is especially easy to do. It's an incredibly bright CV in the infrared. So it's not very hard to do. And this is probably 2 years ago, this is about as high a quality infrared spectra as you could get of these kinds of objects. So it's been a growing field. There are now much better spectrographs on much bigger telescopes in the infrared. But even UGEM looks like the secondary is somehow CNO processed in the system we all know and love and thought we understood. Now, if we go back to theory, because we know theory tells us the truth and observations will catch up someday, our hope. We can take that. What's that?
You've got that on tape.
Yeah, don't show it to any of my collaborators, though. If we go back to those same models, those 1 million CVs that we model, we follow their evolution and we look at where they would be today. But now we plot them instead of m dot, the magic property we never can measure, but we all use to plot. We plot them in terms of orbital period, but now the mass of the secondary star. So you pick from a box, you pick two objects that could be a CV someday. You plot them together in some orbital period at random, and then you let them evolve and you see if they become a CV. If they don't become a CV, they're not on this plot, you throw them out. And you pick another one at random and you watch its evolution, you pick another one. Well, you do that for enough systems, something of the order, to get a million at the end, you have to pick about 30 million to begin with. And this is where they would be in terms of this particular space. And again, it's a log scale, so not only are most of them down here, like we already saw, most of them are at short orbital period. But the more dramatic thing about this particular graph is that below the period gap, they define a really narrow sequence, a very narrow sequence. And in fact, as we'll see, this sequence here is the main sequence mass radius relationship. That's what this sequence is. Above the period gap, there are kind of a mess, but there's two things you notice. There's this kind of sequence here, and then this sort of thumb part that sticks down below it. And these are a particularly interesting set of systems. These are systems that have low-mass white dwarfs that are 0.3 or 0.4 solar masses, and very low-mass secondaries that are also about 0.3 or 0.4 solar masses. So the mass ratio here is about 1. And these particular systems form as interacting binaries for a very short time. And then they hit the period gap and they aren't interacting anymore. There's no mass transfer anymore. And then they end up as part of this sequence. So these are very short-lived phases, and these are ones that right above the period gap have a mass transfer rate that's about 10 to 50 times higher than these systems. And these, we believe, are the nova-likes. And so if you could measure the masses very accurately, and found that all the nova-likes had low-mass white dwarfs and low-mass secondaries with a mass ratio near 1, then they would all be in this range here, and you'd jump up and down and say, this is great. The problem is, you can't measure the masses that well.
But wait, the m-dot's high because it's just come into contact?
It's just come into contact, yeah. They're basically in non-thermal equilibrium during that time period. Now, we talked a little bit before about could the secondary stars be highly evolved, and could all the CNO burning be part of the secondary star so that the secondary, before it comes into contact, it maybe has evolved and almost it's a giant, or maybe it's even moved up the giant branch? Well, this is a calculation that looks at the percent of the main sequence lifetime that a secondary star undergoes before it comes into contact, as a function of the mass of the star that becomes a secondary. And the calculation cuts off at one solar mass for two reasons. there aren't many CV secondaries that can have many CVs that can have secondaries greater than a solar mass, because the star is big enough that the orbital period has to be longer than about 10 hours. And there just aren't many of those. And the other reason is that my particular code doesn't know how to deal with stars bigger than one solar mass in terms of evolving their interiors. So that's the real reason, but it's an okay reason in this case. There just aren't going to be many cases out there. So what you see here is you see these two groupings of stars, and this grouping down here are the group of stars that don't form as CVs until they're at very short orbital periods below the period gap. And they form with very low mass secondaries, which live a long time before they become a CV. But their evolution before they leave the main sequence is even longer. And so they only make it to a few percent, 5% or so of their entire main sequence lifetime before they become become in contact. The ones above the period gap make it a little longer, but maybe even up to 20 or 30% of their main sequence lifetime before they become into contact. So this seemed to me to be pretty clear evidence that the number of secondary stars and CVs that have evolved off the main sequence before they became a CV is almost nil. It's just almost none at all can do that.
And the initial conditions as far as orbital separation, so you start, you're picking two stars, right? Mm-hmm.
You selected at random based on looking at some work that was done on wide binaries by two or three observers, Helmut Apt and a few other people, and they've sort of parameterized what the separation space is of all known binaries. So you pick at random from that selection, and then you follow different paths. They can do all sorts of different things. Most of them don't become CVs, of course. It's a small path. So we have a prediction of what the mass of the secondary star should be as a function of orbital period. We saw that beautiful theory, and boy, I'll tell you, it looks like it's real good. And we have a prediction of what the mass radius relationship is for main sequence stars. Well, let's look at how the two compare, and let's look at how observations compare with those two. So in this plot, this is the mass of the secondary star over here as a function of orbital period. And the solid line from this point up to here is the line the secondaries would follow if they followed exactly the main sequence mass radius relationship and you plop them into interacting binaries. This line down here is the line they would follow if they followed the main sequence mass radius relationship for shorter orbital periods. It's also the line that theory predicts they would follow, because these stars down here are fairly dense. Their equation of state is fairly stiff. So even though they're losing mass, their adjustment period of losing mass is so slow, they go to shorter orbital periods so slowly, they can always stay in thermal equilibrium. Their Roche lobes are almost spherical. They're not very egg-shaped. And so below, theory predicts that the stars should be mass-radius relationship just like main sequence stars. Now, it doesn't predict that temperature or the density of the stars as a function of spectral type, whatever that means anymore, are all the same anymore. It just predicts that their mass and radius have this relationship. So even if you believe this is true, you can't take a mass or a radius and go look up all the rest of the parameters and believe they're true too. The dashed line is the line that theory predicts the secondaries would follow above the period gap in their mass radius relationship. And the reason it's different from the main sequence relationship is because the secondary stars and CVs are bloated right above the period gap. And you can see these two curves are heading together up here. They run into each other at about 6.5 hours, where the star has been a CV for such a short period of time that it still is basically a main sequence star. And that goes back to your question about age determination. If you go between 6 and 8 hours, the secondary stars are almost as if they weren't even in an interacting binary. So this is what you believe it would be for secondary stars that are out of thermal equilibrium. They're bloated for their mass. Well, the points are the observations. And two things strike me about this diagram. Above the period gap, there's not enough information to tell anything. It looks like it could be either or none. And below the period gap, I think there's an interesting answer down here, an interesting effect anyway. Below the period gap, what it looks like is that there's enough measurements down here that I would believe that these show that this relationship doesn't work. And that's really unfortunate, because it's not only the main sequence mass radius relationship, it's the relationship that theory likes as well for the secondaries. So this to me looks like the secondaries below the period gap, the very shortest period systems, have some other mass radius relationship going on that isn't what theory thinks and isn't the main sequence mass relationship either.
How are donor masses measured?
These donor masses down here were measured by getting spectra either at low states in magnetic systems or during eclipses in disk accreting systems. So you look during the eclipse, you have about 10 minutes when you hide most of the accretion disk and you can see the back of the secondary. And you do that two or three orbits and you co-add the spectrum. It's always the same phase. So then you look at the spectrum, and then what you say is, oh, that's a spectrum. That looks like a certain kind of star. And you try to assign it a mass.
It's not dynamical.
That's right. No. Most of these masses are not dynamical because dynamical masses tend to give you overestimates of the mass of the white dwarf. Or for the secondary stars, it's hard to get dynamical masses unless you have infrared spectra. And infrared spectra with time resolution and velocity resolution have only recently been available for most of these. So the secondary stars don't have dynamic masses at all. Now you raise a good point because not only are these not dynamical, we know from observations of systems where we've seen the secondary star in the infrared, the effective spectral type changes as a function of phase. So if I measured it at during eclipse, I'm measuring the back end of the secondary star. If I measure it at a different phase, I get a different spectral type, so therefore I would get a different mass. So while these have small error bars, it's only a small error bar in determining the main sequence type. So this plot begs the question, which is we really don't know the masses of the secondaries either. We don't know the masses of the primaries either, so or the masses of anything. Mass ratios are good. That's right. Mass ratios are good because at least we know those. Yeah. All right, so I just want to finish by looking a little bit at a particular case, which so far is the only case like this. And whether it's particularly odd or we just haven't found any more, who knows. But this is a magnetic cataclysmic variable, polar, which is EF Eridanus, has an orbital period of 81 minutes, which is near where the systems should have a degenerate secondary and they should start evolving back to longer orbital periods. The white dwarf in this case is very cold. It's got a temperature of about 9,500 degrees Kelvin. If you fit models to the optical spectra of the white dwarf and constrain those with the known distance to the system, you get mass for the white dwarf of 0.6 solar masses. And distance is about 125 parsecs. This distance was supposed to be measured 3 years ago with HST. We had a program to get a parallax, but it can't do it when it's in a mass off state because it's too faint. But we're getting other information, so that's okay. But there are some constraints on its distance from the Naval Observatory catalog because it was bright when they took the measurement. So its distance is about 125 parsecs. The mass donor on one side has a temperature that's consistent with about 900 degrees Kelvin. On the other side, its temperature is consistent with about 1600 degrees Kelvin. And the mass is probably something like 0.04, something like that. We of course, don't have dynamic masses, so we don't know. But that's what the mass estimates are based on, not only models, but fitting model spectra, as I'll show you in a moment.
Can I ask a brief question?
Sure.
The obvious interpretation, I think, for this is that one side of the donor is being irradiated.
Mm-hmm.
Done models.
I will show you those in about three slides, and that's our interpretation too. Although I have to say that 2 months ago we got some Gemini data on this object, and our interpretation might be changing. But let's not go into that. We can talk about that at the end if you want. But our interpretation was irradiation as well. It entered a low state in 1966 or 67. We don't know exactly when because people don't watch these things all the time. And it's been, 96 or 97, and it's been there ever since. This is the longest known low state a polar has ever been in, and this is the lowest low state, and I mean that from the sense that there are absolutely no emission lines left in the optical or the infrared spectra of this, not even little baby emission lines at H alpha. It just seems to be completely devoid of any mass transfer. So CV evolution, if you believe those evolution plots I showed you earlier, for this orbital period, you have two choices. You can be above the place where the secondary star becomes degenerate, or you can be past the place where the secondary star becomes degenerate. If it's above, the secondary star is about 0.1 solar masses and has an effective temperature of 2900 degrees Kelvin. And if it's below, it's in this range somewhere. And this possibility has been completely eliminated. This system is just cannot be 2900 degrees Kelvin at all, nor have this mass and be cooler, because you can't make those kinds of stars. So the secondary star probably used to be some normal main sequence star, though, probably. So in something of order 7 or 8 giga-years, 98% of its mass has been given up to the white dwarf, and the thing is now some remnant thing. And again, it looks like it has no or low carbon, and we can think of an acronym for WART if we want to here. So now one of the problems with this, and this is a great audience to be talking to this about, there is absolutely no models of this kind of an object. There are no interior models, there are no atmosphere models, there are no models of this secondary star at all. So somebody should do some. Peter Hauschild has been trying to make atmosphere models, but when you tell him, no, lower the carbon, his models fail. And so he's working to try to get them to be fixed. But if you get rid of carbon, opacities change a lot, because you got a lot of oxygen now that's freed up. If you don't have CO, you got a lot of free oxygen, and that oxygen goes somewhere. And so his models get all screwed up. So he's working on it. And that's just an atmosphere, but the interior structures of these would be wonderful to know what they are and how they work. So just to look a little bit back at theory, this is a theoretical diagram. Again, it shows that curve part at the end of the track in orbital period, where normal secondaries up here and some kind of weird degenerate secondary things here. But now I've plotted surface temperature of the secondary star. And you can plop down some measurements here of the secondary star's temperature. And you see that above this thing, the few that there are don't seem to agree too well, although the error bars are kind of big on those. And down below, boy, look at this. Looks like theory is really, really doing something great down here, because down below, a lot of them fall kind of near the curve anyway. But WZ Sagitti and EF Airy and HV Virgo all fall here. And while for an observer, you could probably say, oh, geez, it's on the same plot. That's pretty good. But for a theorist, this is quite a difference here. And the reason is because the uncertainty is in this direction. The uncertainty in orbital period is essentially zero. So the uncertainty is this direction, which means that these seem to have a temperature that's 500 degrees hotter than they should be. Well, I think I have an answer for that. It goes back to the irradiation idea. And so remember that as we go on a few more slides here. So let me show you the optical spectrum of EF Airy in 1997. So this was a year or so after it entered its low state. And this was taken actually by Gavin Ramsey, but this was a particular analysis in a paper a year later by Klaus Berriman and his group. The straight line is a white dwarf model fit here to this spectrum. And it's a fit of a typical DA non-magnetic white dwarf. But what you see in the actual data is these three bumps here are the pi and sigma components of H alpha Zeeman split, because it's a magnetic white dwarf. It's got a field near 30 megagauss. And so you see the Zeeman splitting here. So it's not quite the appropriate model to fit. But if you ignore the lines and you just fit the continuum, it works pretty well. And so white dwarfs, fortunately, in their continuum are more or less like black bodies, so it's kind of nice. This is the components of H beta up here just splitting the helium line. So their fit to this thing was at about 9,500 plus or minus 500 degrees Kelvin. The difference out here, there's actually two spectra laid on top of each other out here. And the difference between the two, they attribute to cyclotron radiation. Which was still prevalent here. You can kind of see this hump structure right here, and it's equivalent to where a hump should be for a 30 megagauss field, and that's just what's shown in this diagram up here. And they said in their paper that no secondary star was visible out to 9,000 angstroms, so the secondary had to be later than or roughly equivalent to an M9 star. M9 stars have temperatures around 1,800 degrees Kelvin. So anything hotter than about 1,800 degrees Kelvin would show up here, and it's just absolutely not there. So this was a real good start, and this was the first year or so after the star went into a low state. Now we got another spectrum of this object in the optical last year, in 2002. Covers a little broader range. You can see now that the emission lines are completely gone. There's just absolutely no emission here whatsoever. This is the H beta component. This is the H alpha component over here. Sorry, this is H beta, this is H gamma. And at first I thought these were residual emission lines, but in fact they're just the continuum chopped up by the Zeeman splitting. The reason you can tell that for two reasons. You can model these very nice with Zeeman components, but the other reason is that H alpha would always be the strongest emission line. And the Balmer decrement between H alpha and H beta, if this was H beta, H alpha would have to stand up to about here. It's just absolutely not there. And you also notice that there's no indication of the secondary star here. In fact, you notice that continuum drops. It doesn't even level off. This is purely just a white dwarf spectrum. You also notice something interesting, which I never thought about before, that this continuum here is not a black body at all. You can see it has a very odd shape to it. And in fact, it's because of the Zeeman splitting, the magnetic energy here actually partitions the continuum up slightly differently. And so black body fits aren't really all that perfect if you have a high magnetic field. And this particular shape changes as a function of rotation of the white dwarf, which rotates with the orbital period, because you view the magnetic field at different levels. So it's actually kind of a really interesting system to try to fit this, because it changes all the time. And so you probably, if you guys have a magnetic white dwarf model fits, it'd probably do a much better job at telling us a temperature. This here? This is the Earth's atmosphere. Sorry, that's the Earth's atmosphere. Yeah, the pesky atmosphere. So the optical really wasn't going to help us learn anything about the secondary star because you can't see the secondary star. And if you looked at this object today, if you didn't know this used to be a CV, you would never know it was a CV. You would look at that thing and say, oh, a magnetic white dwarf, and you would just go away. So this is the infrared light curves in J, H, and K bands. So it's about 1 micron, 1.5 microns, and 2 microns. And if we concentrate on the top light curve first, pretend like you don't see the bottom ones for a while, the line drawn on here is a model fit that fits the white dwarf flux, and the dip here is when the magnetic pole region gets self-eclipsed by the white dwarf. So you've got a white dwarf, and on one point there's a magnetic pole that's slightly hotter than the rest of the surface. And once per orbit, that gets self-eclipsed by the white dwarf, and it drops the flux just a little bit. And if you go back in time and look at high state measurements and keep the same phasing based on polarization measurements of knowing where the white dwarf magnetic pole is, this works out exactly with those phases. So we were fairly confident that this is the eclipse of the polar region, which is still slightly hotter, even after all this time, still slightly hotter than the rest of the white dwarf. And that's the J band. Now, if you move to H and K, now let me show you all three just for a moment, you see they have completely opposite light curves. These are simultaneous. These were taken simultaneously, completely opposite. Well, what happens at H and K, to sort of jump ahead, is the secondary star dominates the flux here. The white dwarf still dominates the flux at J. I mean, that's just for a binary star observer, that's just an incredible statement to say that you've got some secondary that's so cool and so low luminosity that the white dwarf, a cool white dwarf, still dominates the flux at J. So here, what we're seeing is this big lump that occurs near phase 0.5. So you're looking right at the front edge of the secondary star. And these models are exactly what you said. We've modeled this based on irradiation models, where we know the temperature at this point from infrared spectroscopy. We don't know the temperature at this point because the infrared spectroscopy that we had at this point is nothing but noise. This is almost a magnitude difference here. It's an incredible variation. So the signal noise here was barely okay to try to get a temperature. The signal noise here was crappy. So we knew the temperature here. So if you fit this as an irradiation model, and use these two as two wavelength points to tell you how the irradiation works, you can then find the temperature at this point based on irradiation models. So here it's about 1800 or 1600 degrees Kelvin. Here it's about 900 or 1000 degrees Kelvin. So the white dwarf the secondary star has a very strong temperature gradient on it. And if you looked here and tried to get a spectral type, well, I don't know what you would get, but it wouldn't be the same as the spectral type here. This is in the range of brown dwarf temperatures. But this doesn't really look much like a brown dwarf in terms of its spectrum at all. Now let me show you a blow up of this is the ST Leo Minor spectrum that I showed you earlier in a low state. Again, it's the K band. This is at 2 microns. The spectral type in this case is somewhere between M4 and M6. And there's two big features you notice that occur in this. The big water features, it's this and this big feature here. This is the Earth's atmosphere, ignore these lines over here. This is a sodium line, this is a calcium line, and then here's the CO band heads. You can see them all going down, they're very nice. It's carbon monoxide of CO. So this is what you expect for an M star. This is what a typical M star spectrum looks like, whether it's in a CV or not. It's a pretty typical M star spectrum in the K band. Now let me show you the K-band spectrum of EF Airy. Now you can't quite see the colors too well, but you can kind of make out there's a ucky green one and an ucky blue one. They look really good on this. They're like kind of green and purple. But so the green one here is the K-band spectrum of EF Airy's secondary star, and the blue thing here is a 1600 degree Kelvin model brown dwarf spectrum. And you notice there's two things that are clearly different in the two. One is this line, which is the sodium feature. It's just not there. And this is the first CO band head, and it's just absolutely not there. But you notice that the water features seem to match up pretty well. So the water is appropriate for a temperature of 1600. This is a spectrum of the bright phase of the secondary star. So the water features look like they're fine at 1600 degrees Kelvin, but the sodium looks like it's just not there, and there's clearly no carbon. You can see the rest of the CO band heads, and they're just not there at all in this particular star. Now the Gemini data, which are in rough form, and so I don't have a view of them, but we now have three phases. We took data for a couple hours, but it's only enough to separate the secondary star into three phases. And it sort of looks like this when it's at the bright phase, which is good because it's consistent with our previous measurements. But the other two phases don't match with any model or real spectrum of any brown dwarf we can find. The spectral energy distributions are different. The lines are all different. It just looks like nothing that's out there. So that's kind of interesting. And hopefully that'll get reduced and out one of these days. We're working on it. So let me just summarize on EF Airy just to maybe give you some of the scale of how great these observations really are and how unique this system is. We were just so lucky that this thing's in a low state. The stars here are the spectral energy distribution when the star is in a high state and has accretion turned on. So it's a lot brighter, of course, but it more or less has the same shape. And now here we are down here in this world of low state. Here's a 9500 degree black body. And these four measurements are BV, RNI, photometric colors in the optical. It looks like it matches pretty well. And then these are our JH and K measurements, the solid filled circles in the infrared. Now the problem is at J, as we mentioned, the white dwarf still contributes quite a bit. So if you subtract the white dwarf away, you get the squares. And you can see in K, there's not much contribution. In H, there's a little. And in J, there's a large contribution still from the white dwarf. So if you subtract away the white dwarf, you get these filled squares. And if you take an L8 brown dwarf spectral energy distribution, and you move it up and down, not scaled by distance, because it doesn't work if you scale by distance, but if you move it up and down until it kind of matches, it sort of has the right spectral energy distribution when you're in the bright phase of the star. So the side that's facing the white dwarf looks to be about 1600 degrees Kelvin and sort of looks like it has the same spectral energy distribution as a brown dwarf. The other points, which aren't on here yet, but the other points don't follow that pattern, I can tell you that. They follow some pattern that's different. So just to end with a nice picture to show you the actual sizes of things going on here and how maybe more interesting this system is. This is the white dwarf, and it's actually drawn to scale. You hardly ever can draw a white dwarf to scale. It's actually drawn to scale on this. This is the secondary star filling its Roche lobe. The Roche lobe of the white dwarf, of course, is larger. Here's the size of the planet Jupiter. You can see this thing's about the size of the planet Jupiter. And here's the distance between the Earth and the Moon. So it's really quite a tiny little system. So if you put some weird star where the Moon is that was about the size of Jupiter, it would be about the dynamics of the system, and the Earth is about the size of the white dwarf. So that's what we have. It's a fun system to study. So thanks a lot. Please, questions, comments.
So I have a sort of maybe clarification. So the EF Airy fits what you expect from theory for a close turnaround object?
No.
No.
No. EF Airy was that hand-drawn point, if you remember that plot. EF Airy seems to fall where all the rest of them fall, which isn't on the line.
Yeah.
It's hot for that orbital period, but that's the irradiated side. If you take the back side, it actually fits right on the theoretical relationship in temperature, but not in mass.
In temperature, but not in,
but not in mass, yeah. Yeah, a lot of them seem to fit in temperature, because if you, the other two up there were WZ Sagetti and HV Virgo, and WZ Sagetti's measurement was taken right after an outburst, so you might imagine the secondary was a little hotter on that side. And HV Virgo, we don't know, but let's assume it too is irradiated. Then those three are brighter because they have an irradiated side. The white dwarf is close enough, and there's not enough disk to shield them that they might be irradiated. So if you believe that, and you believe that they all work like EF Airy, all of them drop down to just beautifully where they should fit on the theoretical relationship in temperature, but not in mass.
But then for those systems, what are the time average end dots? I mean, given that that much is working, you should be able to predict the time average end dots.
But these are the temperatures of the secondary, not the primary, right? The time average M dot for WZ Sagetti is probably 10 to the minus 11.3 or something like that, 11.5. It's kind of acting normal over, well, although it had this outburst, it wasn't the right time, but regardless of that, it's kind of acting normal. HE Virgo only has an outburst about every 30 or 40 years, maybe. We only know of two, and they're 30 or 40 years apart, so, you know, who knows what that means. And EF Airy is a polar, so it kind of is different. It's never had an outburst, and it's now in a low state. So the good news, maybe, is that all of their secondaries seem to be the same, even though they sort of act differently in these other ways. It looks like they all have these very strange, cool secondaries. So maybe that's the good news.
Steve's here all day tomorrow. He's sitting somewhere in the building.
Yeah, I'm kind of above the receptionist.
Yeah.
So, yeah, please come by and bug me and tell me what's goofy about all this stuff and why it doesn't work. And bring your white dwarf, your magnetic white dwarf models. And that would be great. That'd be great if somebody
did.
Yeah. Can you have it done by tomorrow?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay,
thanks.
Yeah. No, thanks.